This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'll be speaking with Mark Warren at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, Zakiya Sankara-Jabbar, the co-founder of Racial Justice Now in Dayton, Ohio, and Jonathan Stith, the National Director of the Alliance for Educational Justice in Washington, D.C. They are all contributors to a book published in 2018 entitled Lift Us Up, Don't Push Us Out, that features chapters by leaders in the educational justice movement from communities across the United States. This movement has arisen because of the failure of educators, policymakers, and school districts on their own to create a truly equitable and inclusive system of public education. The adoption of zero-tolerance disciplinary policies, the emergence of the school-to-prison pipeline, the widespread closing and replacement of neighborhood schools by for-profit charters in major cities, all have seriously reduced the access of children from discriminated against or under-resourced groups to learning experiences that truly embrace the nation's commitment to equal education and equal opportunity. By organizing on the local, regional, and national levels, youth, parents, and teachers have been able to push back against harmful policies and practices and stimulate meaningful systemic changes in a growing number of school districts. By drawing on the power of community organizing, they are demonstrating how grassroots activism with regional and national linkages can motivate reforms that truly meet the needs of students and families where they are. Welcome, Mark, Zakiya, and Jonathan. To begin with, how did you get involved with the educational justice movement?
This is Mark Warren, and I can start off. So thank you, Greg, for having us here today. We appreciate the opportunity to talk about our book, Lift Us Up, Don't Push Us Out, Voices from the Front Lines of the Educational Justice Movement. I'm a professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, and I've been studying and working with community organizing groups, parent and youth organizing groups, who are working for educational justice for over 25 years now. So I've been involved with community organizing for a long time. About 5 or 6 years ago, things started to change. Before that, I was mainly working with groups that were locally organized, that is, just working in their local areas. But a number of years ago, many of these local groups started coming together, forming coalitions like the Alliance for Educational Justice, with Jonathan here, and the Dignity in Schools campaign that Zakiya is the national field organizer for now, as well as the Journey for Justice Alliance and others. And so in my view, although we've always had an educational justice movement, there seemed to be something new coming together, where local groups were finding ways to band together, not just to influence Washington, but also to form alliances that could support and bring resources to the local organizing that they are doing. And I saw an opportunity to help support this movement. I consider myself more of an activist or community engaged scholar. I don't want to study movements from afar. I want to help organizers deepen and expand their work and document and bring those struggles to light. And I think it's important for policymakers and scholars who might be listening to this podcast, because, you know, at the Education Policy Center, to understand that, you know, we have an important role, but to really make change that's going to really impact the education and increase opportunities and racial equity in our schools is also going to take a grassroots movement that works together with us. And so the voices and participation of those folks have to be forefront. And that's what this book has tried to do, give an opportunity for organizers and leaders like Zakiya and Jonathan and others in the book to lift up their own voices and also to talk about the strategies that they've used to really create change, because I think people have to understand that change can happen, and it can happen when grassroots organizers and parent and youth leaders find ways to connect to researchers and policymakers to do that. So that's what we try to do. That's how a little bit about how I got involved in this latest phase of the education justice movement.
Excellent. So Zakiya, what about yourself?
Oh, yes. Thank you. So for me, I actually got involved a little bit more organically as a parent myself. At the time, my three-year-old was experiencing, and myself really was experiencing what is now known as the preschool to prison pipeline. So where young people as early as three, really babies, are being excluded already from the educational environment, education setting. And so at that time, you know, I wasn't very politicized or anything like that. I didn't really know the language around preschool to prison pipeline or school to prison pipeline. I just knew I was a mom being called constantly to come to the school to pick him up, which was very disruptive to my work. And at the time I was in college, into my studies and all of those different kinds of things. And so for me, that sparked a questioning, a series of questions about, you know, why, you know, my son's, you know, exhibit of normal childhood behavior, things like the things that they would complain about would be, you know, his refusal to transition at transition time, which is, you know, young the students working at stations, or temper tantrums, which for me, I knew was pretty normal for 3, 4, maybe even 5 year olds. And so I was a little bit taken aback at the kind of language and how they would approach me and call me as if it was like an emergency. So that for me sparked again a bunch of questions. I also began to talk to other parents who were there. Was very few African-American parents at this particular preschool, but I did find a theme that most of us happen to be Black women parents was experiencing something similar with our children there, particularly those of us who had sons. And that actually is the impetus of how Racial Justice Now, the organization, was founded. I co-founded the organization with a partner, Professor Vernelia Randall, who at the time was a law professor at the University of Dayton School of Law. And I knew her in the community because she it was like Mark, you know, an activist professor. She did not stay in the ivory tower. She was always in the community at community events, and she was so very approachable and was always lending herself as a resource to the community to be able to help and support folks. So she's one of the first people that I went to and sought sort of refuge and advice and help around what I was experiencing. And so that experience had led to a broader analysis and a broader movement of organizing Black women in particular, but Black parents just more generally in the Dayton, Ohio area, eventually expanding across the state. And that was a series of, you know, just regular relationship building conversations, really, you know, pulling parents, especially those of us who are working class and poor, right? Helping us shed the shame of, you know, experiencing constant suspensions and even expulsions of our children from school. So that for me is how I got into the education justice movement. And now, as Mark mentioned, I am now the national field organizer with the National Dignity in Schools campaign, where I get to go out and support our members across the country with capacity building, strategic planning, and all kinds of other things to help support the field, parent and young people organizing across the country.
Impressive. Great. Thank you. Jonathan, what about yourself?
Yeah, it's a key story. So impressive. I got started as a youth worker in Washington, D.C. Before that, you know, I think I had a very similar experience kind of with my own education, not to the degree that that we heard in Zakiya's story. My generation, I think we were pre-school to prison pipeline, so kind of escaped the coming criminalization. But do remember my mom in fights around trying to keep my elementary school open, fights with the school district when we moved out to Maple Heights, which was a predominantly white school district, fights to keep me in the gifted and talented program. And really kind of standing up against kind of the education racism that I was experiencing. So part of, I think, you know, that shaped who I was. I ended up in Washington, D.C., doing service learning in schools, helping to pilot this program that was going to put 18 AmeriCorps Vistas in all the D.C. public high schools to help students do community service. I'm leading one of the chapters at H.D. Woodson, which is in Ward 7 in Washington, D.C., predominantly African-American community. And I'm trying to get these young folk to do a cleanup at their school, because this is one area that's always cluttered with, like, stone and stuff. And I'm, you know, trying to sell them on it. They're not buying it. And I tried no amount of pizza or t-shirt promises or inflated community service hour offers would move them. And what I have, we had a moment where I kind of had the final breakdown and breakthrough. And they were just like very direct. They were like, we're not going to do it because we already know it's going to be dirty the next week. And to me, that opened a really deep conversation where they revealed that they knew that somebody was dumping on their school grounds. For us in that moment, we came very clear, like the limits of service learning and kind of the idea of community service. We got in contact with this youth organizing group that was doing environmental justice work. That's how we flipped the service learning project. We invited them in. They taught them how to do organizing, and they did an action. They basically, recorded the company doing it. They went to the city council, had an accountability meeting, moved the city council and the city to fine and to stop this dumping. And so for me, that was just a very transformative moment where community service was something that you did because you were in trouble, because you were bad, but youth organizing was something that you did that gave you power, a sense of identity, the level of engagement, the relationships that I had with young people coming out of that was so much more enriching, so much more fulfilling, that I knew that I wanted to kind of continue to do this same kind of work, and then got introduced to Ella Baker, and then really understanding organizing and organizing with Black youth to be a tradition that is to be carried. And so found my way, found a great organization at the time, Listen Inc., that was being really led by someone connected to Ella's legacy, Lisa Sullivan. And that's where I got my start, youth organizing in D.C. Had some really amazing victories. They won the School Modernization Act, which was $3.2 billion to renovate all the schools in D.C. public schools. That's just now ending. And then become part of the alliance who came together at the start of the Obama administration to really try to push federal policy with the opening around No Child Left Behind. And so that's how I kind of got here. That's how I got into education justice.
And it sounds really reminiscent of the work of folks back in the 80s and 90s at the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative as well in Boston, where kids really became a central aspect of that whole community revitalization effort. One of the central messages of your book really focuses on the importance of involving people who are most impacted by educational injustices. Can you say more about what this has looked like, given your own experiences? And you've touched on that already briefly.
So I'll say a couple things about it, and then obviously Zaki and Jonathan can speak directly to it as well. First thing I would like to say is that I think it really matters because people who are the most impacted are the first to identify the issues that are closest to the injustice that they are facing. So in your introductory remarks, you talked about the school-to-prison pipeline. And if we had been having this interview 7 or 8 years ago, almost none of your listeners would have even heard the term school-to-prison pipeline. And the question is, where did this come from? And it turns out that it was Black and brown parents and students who were the first to identify zero tolerance discipline policies and how it was pushing and increased policing in school and how it was pushing them out of school and their children out of school and into the juvenile justice system. And I was talking with a professional researcher a year or so ago, and she was telling me, oh, we only knew about the school to prison pipeline somewhere, sort of early, mid 2000s. And I said, actually, that's not true. I was down in Holmes County, Mississippi, which is one of the poorest counties in the country, largely African American. And I was meeting with folks, with a group there called Citizens for Quality Education. And they were telling me how in 1998 and 1999, they were talking about what they called at the time the school to jail track. And they actually had a film that was done of them laying out the entire analysis of finding children out on the street during school time, talking with them about why they were out there, examples of young people. One of the stories they told me was a group of children were throwing gum at each other on a school bus, and a piece of gum hit the back of the white school bus driver, and he drove them straight to the police station. and 5 African-American boys were actually arrested and charged with felony assault. And this is going back to 1999. So I think that's one of the fundamental issues about why people who are the most impacted, you know, why that we're talking about parents and students in low-income communities of color across the United States need to really be directly involved and at the center of the movement. And the other thing I would like to add to that, you know, speaking as a professor who ends up a lot in, you know, very elite policy circles, I really believe that our model of, which is essentially a top-down model of educational change, is really broken. It's not addressing the systemic racism and inequalities we're facing in our schools. I live in Boston, which is supposed to have the best, or one of the best, if not the best, big city school system in the country. And even in Boston, if you are an entering 9th grader in a non-exam high school in Boston, your chances of graduating from college within 5 or 6 years, if you graduate from high school, are only 11%. So literally 1 in 10 children, mostly Black and brown children in Boston, will even graduate from college. And this is also being one of the best school systems in the big city school systems that we have. So I think that one of the lessons of that is that the issues of educational inequality are really a profound social and racial justice in this issue in this country. And if that's really true, then we do need a social justice movement, an educational justice movement with those folks who are most impacted at the heart of it, if we're really going to shake that system and change it.
So Zakiya, it sounds as though you really were able to bring together a variety of people in Dayton to kind of address these issues. What were they able to really kind of contribute to the conversation there that hadn't been surfaced before in the way that Mark was describing?
Yeah, ditto to everything that Mark said. As I've mentioned, you know, on other sort of podcasts and different interviews, Dayton and Ohio in general, sure Jonathan may agree, is probably one of the hardest places to organize in the country. Why that is, I think, is a variety of reasons. But it was very, very hard work. I think at the time when we launched, Professor Randall and I said we needed to be very explicit that this is a racial justice issue. And that's why we named, actually, she named racial justice now. She said we need to say it and be bold about it, that we want racial justice now, because it's a racial justice issue. And we were sort of provoking people to actually deal with it. Because folks were entertaining, and keeping in mind, you know, the time period, this was during President Obama's first, 4 years of his administration. And so there were conversations nationally and, you know, even locally that, oh, we're somehow in some kind of post-racial society. We're in this, you know, colorblind society. You know, there's an African-American president. But what that actually looked like for regular Black folks in Dayton, which is a very conservative part of the state, it's in Southwest Ohio, about 30 minutes north of Cincinnati, is that regular folks, you know, was catching hell from white people, you know, in the community because he was president. And you know, just the face of, you know, looking at his family, you know, really, really caught hell. We saw rises of incidents of, racist and, you know, just outright horrible things happen. During the time that I was started to organize, a young man was killed by the Dayton police. And, you know, there were several community members who had actually started organizing. It did not make national news or anything. It was a city that was ready to blow up. But of course, you know, you have folks come out like different churches and things like that, who I call sometimes gatekeepers, who squash the energy of the youth at that time. And so when you have just sort of a mix of that kind of sort of consciousness in the community, for us, it made the work a bit more difficult, but we were also more determined. Because what we were able to do was bring out the people, you know, who were not a part of the gatekeeping class, to bring them out of the shadows, including myself, right? To bring us out of the shadows and say, you know, everything is not perfect. There are people in this community that are catching hell. Our kids are catching hell. We were at Professor Randall did an amazing job exposing the data. You know, she had that skill set from her previous career as a public health nurse. And thankfully, Ohio collects pretty good data, disaggregated data. And she was able to expose with our very first school discipline report card, a statewide school discipline report card. I believe we were the first to do that in the country that specifically looked at school discipline. And it's in shock waves, not just throughout Dayton, but throughout the entire state. We started to receive hate emails from different superintendents who were part of elite school districts across the state who had used to been receiving an A on their report card for academics. But when we started to look at the racial disparity, when we started to look at the few students of color that these particular school districts had in their district and how they were treating them and how they were treating the families, it literally blew the lid off of a lot of things in the state. We even saw retribution at the state level when it came to how they started to release the data. We had to use relationships with the school, with the state school board members who represented Dayton and Cleveland to get them to force the Ohio Department of Education to release the data the next year so we could do another report card. I mean, it was very interesting. But at the same time, the positive is that it did get local people talking. It did get some people, not necessarily, I would say, of the gatekeeping class, but people who were generally just interested, people who were generally shocked that we were expelling three-year-olds. It brought people who had been organizing in the 70s and 80s in Dayton and former Black Panther members out of the shadows and saying, you know, we have to stop this from happening to our kids. So thankfully we were able to bring together a pretty good cross section of folks. We were able to organize Dayton school board members to move on several things. And finally, we were able to organize conservative lawmakers at the state level to pass House Bill 318 in 2018, which is a law that would ban pre-K through third grade suspensions across the entire state of Ohio by 2021. So that is a testament of how people who are directly impacted, Black parents, poor working class Black parents, I think that's important. We're not a part of the PTA. We're the parents who are impacted by, you know, quote unquote, we're the quote unquote bad parents, right, who have quote unquote bad kids who are always getting trouble and getting in trouble in school. And so we were able to shift that narrative and say, no, it's not just about bad parents, right? We hate that term. So we're shifting the narrative around it. And it's also not about bad kids. It's about a bad environment and a bad ecosystem that doesn't know how to deal with all children, especially students of color. So that was something that we were able to do. And because we were directly impacted, we were unapologetic about bringing our own narrative and our own answers to what we think needed to be changed. And I think we were somewhat successful.
Sounds really encouraging. Jonathan,
what are some of the most important lessons that you believe people interested in doing something similar in their own communities could take from the things that you've done and learned?
I think it's to get started and take, you know, drawing from what we heard from Zakiya's story to, you know, first believe yourself, like what you're experiencing is real. And then the second thing is that there is something that can be done about it. And the third is that it can be done collectively. What we see from young people and parents and in the book is this just stepping forward, right? It's in the story of G2 Brown and the diet hunger strike. It's this, you know, the story of the young people in Boston of really, you know, speaking up, finding their voice, stepping forward, connecting with others, and moving towards what we really care about. And I think that for those specifically in schools and teachers and connected to education, I think one of the things that we would offer is that oftentimes the thought is that schools are shaped by the society that they are in, that they reflect it, and all of the bad things about society or the inequalities are also at play in our schools. And so what young people offer is an interesting idea and almost a revolution of that idea in the belief that they believe that if they transform schools, they can transform society. And that everything that they're organizing for, whether it's a restorative justice circle, whether it's an interdiscriminatory discipline, it's about a bigger issue than just that what's in front of them. And they are struggling to do that because they do want to graduate, and we do want them to graduate so they can move out of our houses. But the fundamental idea is that they are trying to change the world and transform themselves right from where they're at. And you can do it too. And you're never too old to make that, to step forward and do that. And that is the call and the legacy of Ella Baker, and why she thought the hope of every generation was with this young folk, because they have the courage to go forward where we fail. So always go forward. Be like Fannie Lou Hamer. If you're going to fall, fall forward.
So Mark, in the last couple of minutes that we've got, from the standpoint of community organizing, what are some of the practices that seem most important to keep in mind, and just kind of recommendations for other people who are interested in trying to do similar things in the context of their own communities?
Sure. I mean, I think I would build on, you know, the last couple of comments that we've heard and say, you know, the first thing is that there's no substitute for organizing, and to really engaging young people and parents and communities in the process of change, that's really what where the push and the foundation for a social movement is going to come from. And it's so much easier to do everything else oftentimes, and to sit in comfortable conference rooms and discuss research and policy. It's much harder to go out onto the streets and into the communities, into people's living rooms and into schools to do that kind of organizing. But the other side is to say that I do believe, and I think in this book we try to model, that everyone has a role to play in this movement, that organizers like Zaki and Jonathan are really key, and parent and youth leaders are key. But we also have educators by essays by teachers, teacher activists in the book, because they're the ones in the classroom. And we can push for change on the outside, but we also need to transform the hearts and minds of our teachers on the inside. And beyond that, we also have essays by scholar activists, policy people, and even people who are not directly in what we think of as education, people in the labor movement, in the LGBTQ movement, because we understand, I think, as Jonathan was putting it very eloquently too, that, you know, changing schools is changing society, and that we all have a stake in what's going on in our public education system. The issues that children bring into school, if they're poor, if they're homeless, if their parents are working two or three jobs, low income, if they're suffering from environmental racism, these are all affecting our educational system. And we need a larger, more intersectional social justice movement that really has educational justice at its heart, but is also addressing economic justice, environmental justice, climate justice, LGBTQ rights, and all the issues that are facing our children and families in this country. And so we are actually forming a people's think tank out of the process of people coming together around this book. And, you know, we invite people to check it out and to think about getting involved with us and getting involved in the educational justice movement in whatever position that they find themselves. Because in the end, you know, we have to ask ourselves, and this is how we end the book with the question, you know, is our next generation of young people, are they going to be fodder for a low-wage capitalist economy working in McDonald's for the rest of their lives? Are they going to be fodder for a prison system and mass incarceration? Or are they going to be change agents in their own lives and in their own communities? And I think we all have to take a stand on that issue.
Well, many thanks, Mark, Zakiya, and Jonathan, for your commitment to finding ways to involve a much broader proportion of the citizenry in educational decision-making and reform. This is Greg Smith, the National Education Policy Center. April's Education Interview of the Month will be with Madhabi Chatterjee, a professor of measurement, evaluation, and education, and the director of the Assessment and Evaluation Research Initiative at Teachers College, Columbia University. She has recently written a consumer's guide to testing under the Every Student Succeeds Act. In it, she explores the variety of options that states are pursuing to assess student achievement and meet federal reporting requirements in this post-No Child Left Behind era. Her guide emphasizes both the advantages and the limitations inherent in current testing options. We invite you to join us for another podcast.